Hi, and welcome to the Now Spinning Magazine podcast with me, Phil Aston. And I'm delighted to welcome back Martin Popoff, musicologist and rock author extraordinaire, where in this episode, we're going to be discussing Flat Out by Buck Dharma, the Blue Oyster Cult lead guitarist. There's a vinyl version. I have a wounded version of that down on the floor somewhere behind me. And would the songs in this album have made for an exceptional Blue Oyster Cult album, or are they better where they are on Buck's only solo album? So we're going to go through each track and look at each one and have a quick discussion about whether we think each song would be better as a Blue Oyster Cult song, or does it really feel like a solo offering? Now, the album came out in 1982. I must point out at this time, there is a fantastic book, which Martin's going to talk about. There's an update coming up, which he wrote about Blue Oyster Cult. This was 1982, Martin. Before we start, just give us a little bit of background to what was going on in the world of Blue Oyster Cult at this time. Fire of Unknown Origin had come out. They were doing another live album. And Buck was starting to think, I've got all these songs. What shall I do with them?
Yeah, so Fire of Unknown Origin came out June 22nd, 1981. So there was the whole Black and Blue tour before that. And, you know, they got some of their momentum back, right? Mirrors didn't sell very well. Cultosaurus didn't sell very well. Fire of Unknown Origin had Burning for You. It did well. So move up to April 19th, 1982. And we get the live album, Extraterrestrial Live. Okay. Yeah. So importantly, we've lost Albert at this point, and Rick Downey is drumming for them. And then June 15th, 82. So just like 2 months later, we get Flat Out.
Yeah.
And then November 8th, 83, we get The Revolution by Night. Right.
Yeah.
So that's sort of your timeline. So yeah, there's turmoil in the band because we are going to lose Albert, and Albert is an occasional singer and a more than occasional writer in the band. Extraterrestrial Live doesn't really do a heck of a lot for them. It's a double live album. It's one of those that I put in that category of the bloated second live album that isn't considered as exciting, although it's the third for Blue Oyster Cult. They got a single live album in there as well. They got On Your Feet or On Your Knees, 75, Some Enchanted Evening, 78.
Yeah.
So this is the corporate live album. So it doesn't do that much for them. And then really, this doesn't do very well either. Produced by Bruce Fairburn, it's a bit marred by electronic drums. Take Me Away is a bit of a hit on it, but nothing else is really a hit on it at all. There's a couple other things floated as singles. So I'll stop there. So that is your sort of timeline. And you're right, Buck. Just to mention, so what happens is, Buck just has turned out to be, I don't think there's anything special about it, but Buck has turned out to be the writer of their main hits. He's got these other songs. I guess they're deemed a little bit too poppy in general, in trend, to all be Blue Oyster Cult songs sort of thing. So it's like, okay, so is Buck going to do a solo album at this point?
Yeah, but were they really that poppy? Because comparing when they're coming after Mirrors, etc., because the opening song, Born to Rock, which is not, it's not the first time they put the word rock into one of his songs, but I feel that would have easily fitted into a Blue Oyster Cult album. It would have been a good opener for, where Blue Oyster Cult were at this time. And in fact, it almost sounds a bit like a reworking of Burning for You. In some ways, it's kind of got that feel to it. Do you feel that would?
It's the heaviest song on the entire Flat Out album. So we have a 38-minute album here. There's an instrumental and a couple other weird things, but a lot of ballads and a lot of pop. But so this is the heaviest song. It's not particularly heavy. The neat thing is Blue Oyster Cult played it live in 83 and a couple other times later. And I was playing the YouTube clips yesterday, and they're kind of underwhelming. I mean, it's a little more rocked up, but they didn't really change it in a big way. Frankly, I think this is probably the one song on the album where the studio rendition, what they did in the studio, is maybe better than it sounds like Blue Oyster Cult is playing it live, but that's a bit unfair, I suppose. But overall, I don't really like the production of this album. It's kind of faceless, anonymous, light, maybe too many things in it. It's very analog. It's very conservative. But I think it's just, more or less correct, but there's nothing super exciting about it.
Do you think he, because obviously it would have been the easy thing to do would have been to include some of his bandmates in making this solo album, but I guess would that have lent it more to him? The way some record labels used to be, they let someone go off and do a solo album, then they start to listen to it and going, why don't you put this out as a Blue Oyster Cult album? That would make more sense at this stage. I think Tony Iommi had that, didn't he, with Seventh Star. It was supposed to be a solo album, then someone said, no, it has to be Sabbath. Do you think, was it, from what you know when you interviewed them all in your book, was it a conscious decision from Buck not to include his bandmates?
I can't remember if it was a conscious decision. I mean, Rick Downey is on it. It isn't his bandmates. And I've often sort of conjectured that, or, you know, thought about it, that had he put together a band like he had a little bit later when Blue Oyster Cult was, you know, there was the Red and the Black and all this stuff, right? And, you know, I guess BOC at one point was called 3OC and 2OC and all this. But, had he put together a band, maybe he would have gone off in some solo direction rather than continue with Blue Oyster Cult. I don't know, losing Albert, you know, is part of, you know, the band kind of degrading a little bit, but yeah. And had he maybe had a hit on this, because Born to Rock had a full-on production video made for it. Another one, I think Your Loving Heart has a big production video made for it as well. Kind of goofy, kind of fun. But obviously they were putting a little effort into it. I think the album cover is really good. It's on CBS Portrait, you know, which is kind of a big deal. So, who knows what would have happened, but it's almost better that he didn't have, he didn't have the BOC guys, and B, there's no real band. It's just a bunch of guys.
Yeah. Do you feel that, because Blue Oyster Cult, as they got past the black and white period, and for me in the UK, I left school in 1975, and I can say, hand on heart, with all of us kids back then, we're listening to Sabbath, Zeppelin, Purple, Uriah Heep, Budgie, all these kind of bands, and Montrose and stuff. But none of us were aware of Blue Oyster Cult until the end of 75-ish, when On Your Feet, On Your Knees came out, the live album. And I know quite a few of my friends bought that because of the cover, because it just looked so mysterious and the introduction, etc. But it was a very different sound to, as we went through Engines of Fortune and Spectres, where that kind of ethereal floating lead guitar lines and vocal style started to really emerge. And that's what I feel when you listen to Flat Out, to me, you realize just how much of Blue Oyster Cult's inherent sound came from Buck Dharma and his compositions and his guitar playing, which is why I think the next song, That Summer Night, also feels like it could have landed on a Blue Oyster Cult album. I know it's light, I know it's kind of poppy, but with the way that they'd been traversing through their career, it feels like it would have fitted into one of their albums quite easily.
Yeah. And, I went through this pretty carefully and thinking, I don't really want to hear too many of these songs on a Blue Oyster Cult album. And I don't particularly like this one very much either. I'm not crazy about the melodies on it. I think the next one, Cold Wind, is better. That Summer Night is just too, like, kind of mid-rangey. Yeah. Cold Wind is now you're getting into a good sophisticated ballad, and I like kind of the rainy guitar on it. The one thing I like about this album is there is a lot of Buck playing guitar, and he's got this really sort of unique style that's a little bit jazzy. It's very lyrical, melodic, it's very clean. It seems pretty smart in where he goes with his note choices all along. I sometimes liken it a little bit to Ted Nugent, although it's not as gnarly as Ted Nugent. But it has the same sort of kind of flowing, loopy quality where there's sort of a circular, swirling playing thing going on. But it's also sophisticated and musical, and you definitely get a lot of that on here. So as we move forward, I mean, Cold Wind and Your Loving Heart, to me, are now we're getting into like good quality things, you know, ballads on here that possibly could have been a single. But I suppose Your Loving Heart, that's the other one with the full production video. That's pretty proggy and epic. And I love the story on it as well. It's such a cool one for that, you know, the whole heart donor thing.
Yeah, I mean, Colgwyn has got that kind of, as he said, I think, in the sleeve notes for the Rock Candy version, it's that kind of Twin Peaks guitar echoey kind of 50s, early 60s feel. Yeah, but yeah. I do like it lyrically, and I think that's a very powerful, very wonderful ballad. And I can imagine it's got that kind of feel to it. You can imagine it being on Spectres. But the next one, as you quite rightly say, mm-hmm. Your Loving Heart is something else. This, to me, definitely sounds like Blue Oyster Cult. It's like, you know, it's that kind of tongue-in-cheek, macabre kind of lyrically storyline. And the way it's put together, it is like a suite, isn't it? It is proggy, lots of sound effects and stuff. And it's a very, very clever song. And the guitar playing in the middle section is very restrained, very Buck. That's the other thing, isn't it? When guitarists do solo albums, you don't really know where this is going to go. And you could have easily just think, right, my gloves are off. This is going to be a guitar album, you know, lots of instrumentals, lots of chance for me to stretch out and show everyone what I can do. But he almost just extends his songwriting and just steers it maybe a little bit more to the left than the right, so you might have done with the Blue Oyster Cult album. But it's still, that's why it sounds like a Blue Oyster Cult album in so many places to me. He's just extended the personality we know from him, from the band.
That's right. And the only reason we care is that he's also a singer. You know, it's very convenient that this is a solo album from a guitar player who happens to be a singer. And you're right. I mean, that's a pretty cool insight. The idea that this is even more Buck. This is taking his personality, the one you suspected was there, and and giving you more of that part of his personality that you suspected was there. It's the Buck we get on the Blue Oyster Cult albums, but you know, one or two steps further, and you know, quite rightly, that whole idea of a solo album, it is the thing where people are saying this suite of songs has gone too far to be on a Blue Oyster Cult album.
Well, I guess he's also got the freedom that because of the way that he writes music within the band, that this is almost like a theoretical thing where they all sat around in the studio, and in his mind, he thought, what would it be like if we all sat around to do the next album and everybody said, I have no ideas. What have you got? And and he just said, well, I've got these. Because it's interesting that the idea that maybe he held back some of the best stuff for this solo album rather than shared it with his mates, because obviously on The Revolution by Night, he seems to is less input from him on that album than there was on previous albums. I wonder if it's because this came so soon after Flat Out, he hadn't accumulated enough new ideas to do that. I mean, do you think that's the case?
Yeah, and one other thing I before I forget, I believe there was a story, if I'm getting this right, that the solo album was kind of planned and Buck wanted to save Burning for You for the solo album. And the band convinced him, strong-armed him, the label strong-armed him, saying, no, that's got to go on Fire of Unknown Origins. So I believe part of the idea of, okay, you can do a solo album was Burning for You, you know, is going to be included on Fire of Unknown Origins. So, let's move on to the track. What was your question again on that? Because, before we
It was on this album that he seems to have less input on than previous Blue Oyster Cult, almost as if he had used up a lot of his good ideas, for Flat Out. He doesn't seem to have as many writing credits as he had on previous albums.
Yeah, there's a lot of Joe here. There's some Helen Wheels on vocals. There's Neil Smith. So Neil Smith helps him on Born to Rock, but he helps Joe Bouchard on Shadow of California. We got Sandy in there. We got Eric solo on Field of Thunder. So Buck is writing on Let Go and Dragon Lady. Take Me Away is Eric's. Eyes on Fire is Greg Winter. Shooting Shark is Buck's on that, and Buck is on Veins. But of course, lyrics, we got Patti Smith, Richard Meltzer. So we got the same great stack of lyricists. But yeah, it doesn't sound particularly like an Eric album or a Buck album, because it sounds more like an 80s production album. And that's not necessarily Bruce Fairburn either, because this is early for Bruce Fairburn. You know, he does things later on. So this isn't even his. It's almost like Rick Downey is a big part of it because of the drums or whatever. But these outside songwriters as well are helping out. But you're right. By the time you get to that, I mean, it's just not a very well-received album, and they've lost that momentum. So maybe the idea of having this album out, that's the other thing that's kind of a negative. It's like they should have followed up Fire of Unknown Origin with something. And maybe had they followed it up, you know, quickly, they might have retained Martin Birch and not have his attentions go elsewhere. And maybe we would have got another Martin Birch album.
Yes, because if the next follow-up to Fire of Unknown Origin had have got like something like Your Loving Heart on it, it would have been seen as the centerpiece, I feel, of the next Bluest Cult album, because it would have been, it would have had some of their magic dust on it. I mean, I can't really think of how it could have been improved, really. It sounds, you know, completely complete as a Blue Oyster Cult track.
One way it could be improved is it could have gone on a Meatloaf album. Imagine Meatloaf doing that song. That would have been hilarious, right? Full big, you know, production and Meatloaf with his histrionic voice singing this whole thing.
Yeah, that would have worked incredibly well. That would have worked. After that, you've got 5:35, which I don't think sounds like a Blue Oyster Cult song. It does sound very poppy, and does sound like it's something that would be belongs on a solo album. And in fact, then was it Wind, Weather, and Storm? Did they actually rehearse that a few times? Is that a song that they Bluest Cult kind of played with? Is that,
can't quite remember. So this is kind of a novelty tune.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's kind of like a little jazzy thing. It's got a Richard Meltzer lyric on it, a really cool lyric on it. I think the whole idea, the title's great, and it feels like a Blue Oyster Cult song. We had I Am the Storm before. And just to go back, 5:35, I hate the keyboard sounds on it. There's some good guitar licks on it. My favorite part of it is the pre-chorus. So don't like the verse, don't like the chorus, like the pre-chorus. And I'll get to that a little later in my imagined revolution by night. It's not a good start again to this side, but I do kind of appreciate Wind, Weather, and Storm.
Yeah. And then Anwar's theme, which is the instrumental, this obviously belongs on a solo album. It wouldn't fit on a Blue Oyster Cult album to me, but it is a fantastic song. And again, another showing of the restraint of a guitarist doing a solo album without thinking, right, how many notes can I put into this? His playing is very tasteful, very measured, and very, as you said, very lyrical. Almost as if it's a, If the vocalist could be a guitarist, the guitarist is like playing like a voice. A lot of solos by Buck are like that, aren't they? Along, you know, some of the great songs, I Love the Night and stuff like that, those kind of ethereal kind of ballads. His guitar playing is really, really beautiful.
Yeah. And so, there's that instrumental. And then on the CD edition, you've got Gamera is Missing. So you've got two instrumentals if you go to the CD edition. Anwar's theme is just kind of like soberly put together. Like you say, it's not excessive. You know, this is usually the place where people go excessive. So maybe that's showing another part of Buck's personality. And then we've got All Tied Up, which also could have been a hit. Again, this is one where I love the verse chords and the simplicity of that, the chord sequence. And I really don't like the chorus. I don't think it fits with it at all. Mm. It kind of goes in kind of like an R&B disco Santana sort of like melodic thing. Really don't like that. And the only other tune we've got is another novelty thing. The whole Come Softly to Me, which is just like an old 50s song, you know, vocal thing. Right.
Yeah, that's true. And in fact, while you've just touched on something that maybe in the UK I'm not aware of, is I've got three versions of this album. One's on Wounded Bird Records and the other one's Rock Candy Remaster and the vinyl one. And you've mentioned there's another instrumental on the version you've got. I don't that's not on mine. So I didn't know about
that. Yeah, I don't have it either. I just I just noticed it said it on Wiki. You know, I forget.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure it's in the book somewhere, but I've forgotten about this stuff. But I looked, and then, you know, you go to YouTube and you can play it, sort of thing. But it's so it's not on either of your CD versions?
No, it's not. No, it's not.
Oh, well then,
not
yeah. So I wonder. Yeah, maybe it's the very first American CD issue of it.
Yeah,
I don't have a CD of it. I only have my original vinyl.
In your book, Agents of Fortune, there's a mention that when the album came out, because it didn't sell like he expected, did it? That he was hoping to do another solo album in a couple of years, but he never did another solo album again. Was the experience of this what put him off, or he just got sucked back into Blue Oyster Cult?
Well, the interesting thing about Buck is that he's just not very prolific. He doesn't write a lot of songs. He'll go a long, long time without writing songs. So, and they go on tour all the time. Things were not great. They have another album in 86 that's not well received. The 88 album is not well received. Then they go all the way to 1998 for another album. So, it's just any sort of appreciation for Blue Oyster Cult, you know, he's now of an older generation. So that's the other thing. So there's really no interest. And he's not very prolific, and he's realizing our records aren't selling anymore. So it's just something that just, there's no real need for it anymore.
Yeah. So I was thinking actually in the '80s when that would be the period when a second follow-up solo album may have appeared. I agree that now his interests will be far, far, far away on something else, because it is. I remember reading the, I think it was the album review for which one, Club Ninja, I think it was, in Sounds, or it could have been Kerrang in the UK. And it was a very mixed review. And I think the reviewer said something like, has there ever really been a complete Blue Oyster Cult album to review? And there is that feeling, isn't it, that they never really hit all the buttons that they're on an album completely. Maybe Secret Treaties and stuff like that, but that's going back a while, isn't it? Or, and even this one, which I know is a bit poppy in places, but A Shooting Shark I really like, but it seems like they always run out of steam halfway through side two.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, this comes back to that whole, you know, thing that Led Zeppelin used to say is, oh, we've got a little something for everybody on our new album or whatever, right? And so Blue Oyster Cult is just, they're painted into a corner anyways, because they've got five or six different things they want or are expected to get out there on any given album. So I don't know if I'd agree that they've never had a complete album or whatever, because I some of their albums are my favorite albums of all time. I mean, I would put Spectres, Mirrors, Cultosaurus, and Fire of Unknown Origin, all of those way up my list. So none of those feel incomplete to me, but they do have to check off various boxes. And of course, like I say, you know, when there's only 40 minutes there, you can never be everything for everybody. So when a band says we're versatile, to me, that just means, well, we don't do one thing enough. There's that negative to being versatile too. You know, Black Sabbath gives you a whole pile of great heavy metal. Led Zeppelin, you're frustrated because there's two or three songs of that ilk or whatever, and they're off doing other things. So the Led Zeppelin or Blue Oyster Cult way of doing things is no better than the Black Sabbath way, because they all have only their 40 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, Spectres is probably one of them. I think that's complete. That's probably my favorite one. And Imagine Us, which I know is a different type of animal, but it's a brilliant album, great guitar playing. As you said at the start of the conversation, they were touring with Black Sabbath at this period before Flat Out came out. And in the UK, there was this whole marketing ploy of saying they were the American version of Black Sabbath, and they were never anywhere near that, were they? And they were put on the Black and Blue tour as well, and that's in a way a mismatch, wasn't it?
I mean, those two things don't go together particularly. But going back to the early days, the idea was Black Sabbath was doing well right out of the gates. They're on Warner. Columbia. So Murray Krugman and Sandy Pearlman, and they all got together. You know, they went through these names, Soft White Underbelly and Osaka and what's the Stock Forest Group, and shelved albums. And so the idea was ostensibly that Columbia wanted their own Black Sabbath to compete with Black Sabbath. Bluish Occult comes along. They're more like a hard psych band. You know, they sound like a cross between The Doors and dated heavy metal across those early albums, right? So they were never really going to sound too much like Sabbath. They had great lyrics. Their lyrics were Sabbath quality, maybe even better, I would say. But then flash forward. And then they even get kind of mellower, but flash forward, they're put together with Black Sabbath. And this is, you know, one big reason is Sandy Pearlman is actually managing both bands for a brief spell there. Right. But you know, you got Black Sabbath and Blue, Black and Blue. And then when you go out live, and you know, you play all your heavy songs and stuff, and you've got the leveling quality of a big loud karanging, you know, B City hockey barn, you know, Bluish Occult is going to sound essentially as heavy as Black Sabbath, you know, enough or whatever. And they look pretty heavy as well. And then totally. Bluish Occult was super popular too. So sometimes Black Sabbath would headline, sometimes Bluish Occult would, but Bluish Occult was well known, you know, all across as well. And Black Sabbath, of course, is dealing with, they're doing rather well with it, mind you, but they're dealing with the switch in the lead singer at the same time. So the bill wasn't particularly mismatched. But yeah, you know, those early albums were not nearly doing heavy metal as good as Black Sabbath was.
But you raise a very good point, though, that if we roll back to the early 70s, they were probably closer then, as you write, you know, the songs like Seven Screaming Dizbusters and, you know, that kind of thing. And She's As Beautiful As a Foot. They're very, very mysterious. And as you say, a bit like The Doors, but very older style, you know, heavy metal, you know, a bit Alice Cooper-ish, wasn't it? Bit, you know, very Detroit type of sound, very guitar garagey type stuff. And those three albums, the artwork, the way they flowed from one to the other, kept the mystery up and the symbolism of the logo, etc. So by the time that Flat Out came out, they'd kind of shifted. They were obviously trying to become more commercial. And then the new wave of British heavy metal popped up. And then I think they tried to turn the dials around to be a little bit heavier with, you know, the Marshall Plan and stuff like that. And it was a bit obvious, perhaps, which is why I feel that going back to what we're talking about here is Flat Out showed was a launch pad for what Buck Dharma could have done with his career. Could it, if that had a bigger push behind it, there's some songs on there that could have been mainstream hits. Could he have then had a solo career and also had Bluish Occult continuing at the same time?
Yeah, he probably could have. I mean, he's not a tall, photogenic frontman lead singer guy. So the marketing of it would be a bit of a challenge. And he's also from the 70s, but he can write these great pop songs. I mean, if Buck would have gone all through the 80s and done three more records with big shot producers, I'm sure he would have landed some hits off of those records. One thing I wanted to clarify. Yeah. So this book, I am going to update it at some point. I didn't mean update. I meant like a sequel, because what I'm doing is I'm doing a sequel to this book, Flaming Telepaths. I might call it Perfect Water. It's almost finished. I just actually have to do the illustrations for it, because I did 39 illustrations in this one. And so I'm going to do the same roughly number, but I'm almost finished the update to this. I might call it Perfect Water. So this is a crazy sort of occult conspiracy theory Imaginos related book. So this is the one that, you know, update. I meant sequel, but you know, through Weimer we have been doing some updates and things, and I've actually just dusted off, and we're going to have the old Thin Lizzy book come out again, but this one needs this one is now one full studio album old, Symbol Remains. So I've got to do a new chapter for the Symbol Remains,
but it's a great book there, Martin.
This one as well, right? I've got the big coffee table book. This is the Weimer,
That looks fun. Yeah, that
detailed timeline book
full color throughout, all the memorabilia, 400 pictures. So that's the other one. So
has that just come out? Is it the visual history?
No, that's been out for a little while. Yeah. We've done a few of those. We've done 5 or 6 of those. I don't know how many more we're going to do, but I believe this was the first one. So this was the experiment, I guess. So that one, I just did a really detailed timeline throughout, and then just all the pictures in full color of all the ads and memorabilia and many, many live shots. Sort of thing.
Okay, you said you'd put together a kind of pretend mythical version of Revolution by Night if it had included some of the songs.
Yes, exactly. So what I did was, really going directly to the nub of your question, I thought, okay, so if this had not occurred, because yes. I'm very underwhelmed by this album, right? So I thought, well, what would I include on a Blue Oyster Cult album? You know, calling it a Blue Oyster Cult album and having them do all these songs, I don't think would particularly work.
No,
so my pretend Revolution by Night would start with Take Me Away Still, so the big heavy Eric song.
Yeah, great.
Go into Dragon Lady from side two, which I think kind of fits. Then it would go into Veins, which is also still on Revolution by Night. That was on side one.
Yeah, that's true.
Then I would have a rewrite where the producer would go in, maybe Bruce Fairburn, cracking the whip and saying, I really love parts of 535, parts of All Tied Up, and parts of That Summer Night, and I'm going to put those together and come up with a new song. So that would be your fourth song.
Yeah.
And then Shooting Shark, which is actually still on side one here, would end side one of Revolution by Night. Side two would kick off with Blue Oyster Cult doing Born to Rock, which I think could be a single. It's a great story. Again, this is another one that seems like it's a Meatloaf song, right? Then it would go into Shadow of California. So the one that did kick off side two. Then we'd go into Feel the Thunder, which was also on that album. So you've got Shadow of California, Feel the Thunder, and Born to Rock almost as like a rock and roll 50s biker suite, because they're all kind of nostalgic. And then we'd go into Your Loving Heart. So a big Blue Oyster Cult version of that, you know, ponderous late in the track listing. And then just as a novelty thing right at the end, I'd stick on Wind, Weather, and Storm as to leave you thinking, you know, this is still quirky Blue Oyster Cult leading you into the next album. So, yeah, that's basically three songs from Flat Out and then one complete rewrite, taking all the best parts of those poppy ones.
Well, I'd buy that.
Yeah. Yeah, it'd be cool to hear.
It wouldn't it? Maybe there's a plan when they don't have the energy to go out and play live anymore, they can go back and find all these master tapes and glue all that together.
Well, we've been doing on our Contrarians channel, we've been doing a lot of weird what if stuff. Like we created a concept album out of Led Zeppelin, you know, going through the seasons that just went up. We did a ZZ Top one about driving around. Tim's got one going up about AC/DC and money in the business. And we got one other one. Oh, yeah. The Sammy Hagar, Out of Space, all the space songs. But with Blue Oyster Cult, I actually did two episodes where I made a Doors album out of the Blue Oyster Cult catalog. And I made an Alice Cooper one, because I am amazed. The only two bands on earth that make hard rock quite this way in the 70s are all the heavy songs from the Alice Cooper albums and the songs from the Black and White period Blue Oyster Cult albums. I think they're almost identical. And given that they knew each other and played together and even have written together, it's pretty crazy. But I'm pretty sure the other one was Doors. But yeah, absolutely. There are no two bands on earth that have music that fits together and is so quirky that fits together like the heavy Alice Cooper and the heavy early Blue Oyster Cult.
I mean, your book on them is very text heavy in it. I mean, I've got a lot of your books, but obviously a lot of people looking in from the outside who don't know that much about Blue Oyster Cult. So, well, how much of a story can there be? There's not really anything controversial. You know, they're not Motley Crue. That, you know, but it's a great story, isn't it? It's a story of, of misplaced opportunities and, you know, the way they pull together all the albums, they're all different. It's a great story.
Yeah, well, my favorite part of the story, and by the way, I mean, that book has sold really well over the years. It's been out in three different editions, three different covers, and you know, and the coffee table book did well. The Flaming Telepaths did well. I mean, I sent out a thing to my database saying, should I do an update of this? Because people were speechless when they read Flaming Telepaths. And now I've gotten tons of testimonials because it's really weird. It's all occult and Austin Osmond Spare and World War I and World War II. Just like the whole Imagino story, but I put way more into it. But anyways, so the cool thing, why all this does well, why all the Blue Oyster Cult stuff always does well, because the best part of the story is the stories about the lyrics, that this pile of lyric writers. So Sandy Perlman and the Imaginals thing, Richard Meltzer, who's like an actual fiction author and a great poet himself, wrote the very first rock criticism book, The Aesthetics of Rock. Patti Smith, John Shirley, Helen Wheels, you know, sadly no longer with us. But she wrote Tattoo Vampire and a few other things. Buck would write his own lyrics. That I think is the thing that sustains that Agents of Fortune book more than anything. And then also like Queen, there's all this jockeying because they're all able to write songs. So there's the jockeying of the drama of whose songs get on the albums and the music writing, right? And four of the guys are singing. Out of five guys, Alan sings, I think it's just one, but crazy. There is lots to the story. And like you say, all the albums are different and there is the infighting and all that, but not a lot of drug and drink drama, that sort of thing. Although there is some, I guess you've got the hard living Alan Lanier in there as well. True. Basically succumbed to that later in life. But I've always said this, my favorite lyricists in the entire world are Pye Dubois from Max Webster, Captain Beefheart, Clutch, and the army of writers who wrote everything for Blue Oyster Cult.
But fantastic. Do you think there's some Blue Oyster Cult albums are almost like born in the wrong time? You think that someone like Imaginos, if it did appear in 1979, it would have, you know, it would have been huge. It kind of floated out across the, was it middle of the 80s or late 80s? And just disappeared. And the album they made, I can't remember this one. There was two separate covers for it. The one that came out in the mid 90s, was it?
98, Heaven Forbid.
Heaven Forbid. Because that's a really hard, heavy album. And again, landing in the middle of the grunge period, or when rock was kind of lost until Classic Rock magazine came along and saved it in the late 90s. But if that had arrived earlier, you know, while they were still kind of thinking, are we going in the pop rock direction or are we going to go in the harder rock direction? Mm-hmm. That was, you know, they made a statement with that album. And I always felt that if they brought that out before Club Ninja or, you know, earlier on, even maybe before that, it might have changed their fortunes, literally, with the way that music was becoming heavier and harder at that time.
I mean, it is a heavier album. It's not extremely much heavier. It does move the needle. And also Symbol Remains, people talk about Symbol Remains being their heaviest album, so it's that or Heaven Forbid, and then, you know, the earlier ones in context. But the problem with Imaginos is it had a ton of guest stars on it. It's got weird production all up and down. It's got some really crappy songs on it. It's the story is really hard to understand. And then the label switched the order of the songs around, so it's even more hard to understand. You know, they call it a random access story, so, you know, that's the excuse for it. But it's supposed to be a double album. And Albert, of course, has done two, and now he's doing a third, you know, update where he's taken all the songs and put them in the order that he thinks they should go in. But, you know, frankly, you know, you lose all that momentum having an 81, an 83, an 86, an 88, a 98, a 2001, a 2022. They're touring all the time. They realize that they're not going to sell that many albums. So they're kind of cranky about that. And they don't write a lot and they don't really want to put out a lot of albums. Richie Castellano has really done a good job for them in reviving the band, because that new album, everybody loves it.
It's very good.
So, I don't know. It's to say they screwed up by being out of time. I think they screwed up by not making enough albums, but, you know, Revolution by Night's kind of the right album for 1983, and Club Ninja's kind of the right kind of album for 86. It's just kind of a weird. I've often said this, that Club Ninja reminds me of an album that almost could have come out slightly before Revolution by Night, because it sounds more like Midwest rock rather than hair metal. It sounds like accessible, like heavy Sammy Hagar almost, right? So it sounds like that 1982, 83, Bryan Adams, Sammy Hagar, Night Ranger, even Loverboy sort of feel, rather than, you know, it's almost like they were thinking or trying to make a proper hair metal album and just fell flat on their face because it sounded like 5 years behind the times. It didn't come off like a hair metal album.
No, and the artwork that they chose for that album is also very kind of out of touch with the way that artistic direction was going for rock albums at that time as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, well, so when did you say this is being looked at? Are you looking at this now, are you, Martin?
First I'm going to finish up the follow-up to, where did Flaming Telepaths go? So first I'm going to finish up the follow-up to this,
great,
which is going to be the absolutely hands down the weirdest book I've ever did. But I mean, this was weird too. I mean, it's, like I say, it's got the illustrations in it that I did for it, and it's a straight timeline book. But the new one's even crazier. Definitely the coolest book I've ever done, I think, and I'm dying to get it out. It's more or less finished. So the follow-up to that is, first, Agents does need a new chapter, and I'll dust off, and I've got other talks that I'll put in finally. But that's a neat thing about working with Weimer Publishing, is that they aren't scared about updating the old books and doing whole new layouts and stuff, because that's a big problem with books. I mean, you've got the big coffee table books, say, and they're colored throughout. It's hard to redo the file sort of thing. So that's kind of a little later, maybe early in 2024. That's the other thing. I forgot about that. So what's coming out first through Weimer will be a whole big, thick Blue Oyster Cult book, a panel. I assembled a panel. We went through all of the studio albums.
Oh, wow.
So like I did these panel books with Quarto, we just had one come out through Weimer on The Cure. It's my latest book, called Disintegrating the Cure, or Wild Mood Swings Disintegrating the Cure, album by album. So the Blue Oyster Cult one is the second one in that series for Weimer. And it's like 120,000 words. It's a pretty good long book, but it's basically me and a panel of about 12 people going through every single studio album. And, so that'll be out actually before the end of this year.
And Flaming Telepaths, is that still available from your website? Can people still buy that?
Yes, I've got about half of one box left, but I've reprinted this even two or three times, so I can see keeping this in print, especially after, if I'm still going to call it, Perfect Water comes out. It's either going to be Perfect Water, Imaginos Repatriated, something like that, but he doesn't really repatriate at the end. It's a long story. It's a wacky story. So this is still available.
Well, before we sign off, because just a question, it's just bubbled to the top of my head. I know that you don't like live albums that are too jammy. And we've already mentioned the fact that during this period that Flat Out came out, Blue Oyster Cult released their third live album.
Right.
What are your thoughts on the first one, On Your Feet and On Your Knees?
Funny, we just did a YouTube show on our Contrarians, a live show last night, all about albums you bought because of the album cover. And I'm pretty sure that was my first Blue Oyster Cult album. And I agree with you, the album cover is stunning. With the hearse, is it a hearse?
The gloves holding the prayer book on the end.
And the flag, white flag, red logo, the metal logo. I drew that logo on all my books all the time. The title, the names of the songs. So the funny thing about that one is, even me at 12 years old could realize that it sounded a little dated. It wasn't as good metal as my other albums, but that even made it a little spookier and weirder. And we know the lyrics are really weird on it, right? So it had this depressing sort of late 60s vibe to it. But I did play it a lot, and I appreciated the up ratchet of the production and heaviness over the first three, which are pretty wobbly from a production point of view. So I was quite into it. Some Enchanted Evening, was disappointed with that. It's a single. A stunning album cover. It's the coolest album cover you can imagine. But what I didn't like about it is, I mean, I thought it was pretty cool at the time. I already had MC5 Kick Out the Jam, so it's cool to see them cover something that seemed pretty obscure. But frankly, Kick Out the Jam's ain't that great a song. And then it's got We Gotta Get Out of This Place on it, which I detest. Yeah. I didn't want to hear that on it at all. So on a single live album, that ticked me off. It sold really well. It's one of the best-selling albums, which is pretty weird. So funny enough, I probably do appreciate this one the most. Because it's got so many, and I hate the fact that it's got Roadhouse Blues on it.
That's
kill me now. I never need to hear that again by the Doors or by anybody else, you know. Friggin' Status Quo included, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just a banger collection of songs otherwise. And the good thing about Bluish Cult is they aren't a jammy band live. I mean, they were a little jammy on Your Feet, but I don't think they're particularly jammy on here. They get to the point.
They also, on opening up the first album with The Subhuman, is probably the most unexpected song to open the set with, isn't it? Especially
what came
afterwards, Hot Rails to Hell, etc. But the great album. So everybody, if you don't know Flat Out by Buck Dharma, give it a listen and see what you think. See if you agree with me and Martin, whether some of the songs could have easily made it into Blue Oyster Cult's territory, or whether they were better off with Buck, and could he have done other solo albums, and would his career gone in a different direction? And if you haven't already, check out martinpopoff.com so you can get hold of... is this book still available? Do you have any left? You do.
Yep.
Well, it's highly recommended.
Have that in print.
Yeah. You'll only be one album short, won't you, literally, in the story.
Yeah,
that's fantastic. Well, thank you very much, Martin. Thank you for your time again. This has been, a great adventure into the world of hard rock and metal, as per usual.
Yeah. Such a cool question. You come up with such great ideas. So,
All right. Thanks very much, Martin. And I'll see you again very, very soon. Thank you. So thank you very much for tuning in. And thank you again to Martin Popoff, my guest. And remember to go to martinpopoff.com where you can find out all about his books, his latest books, and all his latest projects. And remember to check out the Now Spinning Magazine website at nowspinning.co.uk. Subscribe to the YouTube channel, subscribe to the podcast, join us on social media. Take care, keep spinning those discs, and I shall see you very, very soon.